Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
It's very difficult to research somebody that spent predominantly 20 years working undercover.
Undercover, yeah, I know, it's difficult. There is a period of time there that's unaccounted for. One, I was discharged from the military, PTSD. That meant any job that my career would lend itself to, I couldn't get.
We find out like 24 hours before, normally, officially.
But get briefed up on who the celebs are. Then we'll do our little moment of fanboying where we're like, oh, no way, that's awesome. You know, I was never taught how to have an argument. I was never taught how to find money I didn't have to pay a bill, deal with sick kids, divorce. Which is bizarre because I never saw myself as a hippie. It turns out I am.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a man who's risen through the ranks of the armed forces to serve first as a Marine, before going on to become, well, one of a handful of soldiers selected to serve in the Special Forces, an elite military unit, which saw him dropped into combat zones to undertake operations as a sergeant. Born and raised in Bedfordshire to a military family, his father had left the Marines by the time he was born. His tales of adventures at sea had clearly resonated. And when he became entangled in petty crime at school, he made the decision to straighten himself out and join the Marines at 16. After 9 years, he applied to join the Special Forces as part of the Special Boat Service. And within months of doing so, 9/11 happened. And he was dispatched on missions in Afghanistan and then Iraq, where he witnessed the very best and very worst of war. He recalls one day lying in a ditch under heavy fire, finding himself yearning for the simplicity of watching TV as a child on the sofa with his mum. It was a moment that would later be diagnosed as PTSD, leading to an abrupt end to his 20-year career as a soldier when he was discharged. At 36, he was thrust into civilian life for the first time since he'd been a schoolboy. And without the structure of the military, coupled with the end of his marriage, his mental health spiraled and things got so dark that for a moment he considered taking his own life. But all that changed when he secured a job advising television crews working in hostile environments. And when Channel 4 decided to launch SAS Who Dares Wins and were looking for leads to instruct contestants through Special Forces training, his name was put into the mix. The show sees him work alongside fellow Special Forces instructors, and over the last 9 years, he's become the man crush of many, putting his skills from his time in service onto the screen. He's also become an outspoken campaigner for men's mental health, something he's explored in two best-selling books, Battle Scars and Life Under Fire, as well as his own podcast, Wild Tales, Book of Man. He's also made a critically acclaimed Netflix series, Meet the Drug Lords, The Real Narcos, where he met, as the title would suggest, real-life drug lords, the kind of men that he'd spent years chasing down as a soldier. And more recently on Channel 4, he's appeared in Fox's Fearless 48 Hours With, in which he spends 48 hours with the likes of Maya Jama and Rob Delaney. In September this year, he married his partner, Jules Hawkins, a producer on SAS, and is the father of two children from his first and second marriages. With a new tour just announced for next year, Life at the Limit, his journey continues. So I'm excited to hear more. Let's dial him in, shall we? It's Jason Fox, Foxy. How are you?
Wow, that was the best introduction I've ever, ever had. That was factually correct and very, very well put. Well done.
Thank you.
I tried so hard.
It's really hard, as you know, to find, you know, the fact from the fiction online, and that's fundamentally where we rely on our research resources these days. And also, it's very difficult to research somebody that spent predominantly 20 years working undercover.
Undercover. Yeah, I know, it's difficult. Like that there is a period of time there that's just unaccounted for. And actually, I disappeared to most people apart from my close family, like school friends, all that. And then literally when the TV thing came about, they're all like that. We wondered where you got to. Yeah, here I am. Hello.
See, I mean, obviously now you're selling out tours, as we all know a tour to be, but a tour back in the day for you was something very different, wasn't it, Foxy?
Yeah, it was normally 6 months away, zero or very, very little contact with anyone that cared about where you were, and involved long bouts of boredom interspersed with absolute horrific terror, which we all found a little bit of fun as well. Yeah, there we go. That was a tour back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to a lot of your books when you explain, you know, I think we all expect it to be like some sort of, you know, computer game, a tour being dropped into Afghanistan. But like you say, it's a lot of sitting around, a lot of boredom. And then you see and deal with things that most human beings would never want to find themselves in the face of. So it's that the extremities of it as well that must be a lot to wrestle with.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, it is. It is an emotional roller coaster. And I think that's the biggest key to it, is being able to understand that it is a roller coaster and you've just got to roll with it, not try and fight it.
It's interesting to hear that, because the irony is that emotionally you're dealing with this roller coaster, so that requires emotional intelligence, right? And we see you demonstrate that so eloquently over the last 9 years on the show, when you're talking about psychological warfare, how your head is as much of a battleground sometimes as the battlegrounds that you find yourself in. And yet when you came out of service, your emotional intelligence and your ability to be able to deal with real life kind of, it was like sand running through your fingers. You just couldn't get the two to work, could you?
I don't think it's common. I think it happens reasonably regularly, but I don't want to typecast all the guys that I've worked with, because there's some people that deal with it very well, and I'll come to why I think they deal with it well in a minute. But ultimately, when it comes to emotions and managing them in those situations that you've just described, as in being away on tour as a soldier, I am actually taught very well how to deal with that. I'm taught to be a soldier to a very high level. It's the other stuff. It's coming home and dealing with home life, something none of us is taught to deal with or how to manage, that massively gets a grip. And like, you know, I was never taught how to have an argument. I was never taught how to find money I didn't have to pay a bill, deal with sick kids, divorce, like cars breaking down. And it's that sort of going into that, not knowing how to deal with it, that actually really does have an impact on you. Now, I didn't know that at the time, but now when I reflect back on it, I'm like, yeah, that it is that. And then obviously the war fighting, the being a soldier is a catalyst, you know, it's quite stressful. So that's obviously, it is going to have an impact. But I was taught to a certain degree to deal with that. It was the other stuff I felt. You know, that's where I lacked emotional intelligence. That's where I lacked the ability to communicate to my other half. You know, I was taught to communicate really well in the military, and yet you come home and I'm like, right, how do I deal with this situation? And
it's interesting because
it sort of fell apart.
Yeah, you don't have the ability to answer back and create an argument in service, do you? So you probably didn't know how to have an argument or make a doctor's appointment, because if you get sick in the army, there's a doctor on site. Or if your car breaks down, well, you don't ever really have a car, do you? You know, everything's done for you or around you.
Yeah, everything's done for you. It's just the stuff on the outside. It's like, I did have a car, it broke down, and I'm like, I ain't got the money to pay for it. It's like, oh my God.
That is tricky. And this is all the stuff that you're sharing when you take the show out on the road next year, am I right?
Yeah, it is. So the show's basically me stood on stage, gobbing off, telling stories, bringing them to life to an audience. And it sort of chronologically follows my life, but the backbone of it is my journey with mental health. Like, I start there somewhere in the middle, then we go back to the beginning, then we come back up and go through that and beyond. And that, you know, there are some somber moments in the me chatting, but there are a lot of funny moments as well, because there's a lot of funny moments normally at my expense throughout my life, which is good.
When you look out and from the stage, tell me about the audience that come to a Foxy show, because I'm guessing there's a lot of men in leather jackets.
What?
I think you might be a bit of a man crush, Foxy.
No. It's very diverse, to be quite fair.
Is it?
I've been surprised at the... Yeah, I think I've seen there's a... I tell you what, so I'm candid within it, and I do swear. It's not, you know, because that's the real me. And there's some young kids in there, which I sometimes get a bit... I'm like, oh, no, there's a kid in there, they're going to hear me swear. But the worst is old people, because then I... It's like having your mum and dad or your grandparents in there, and I'm very conscious of when I swear. I'm like, ooh, God, don't like. So yeah, there's a mixed bag. There are a lot of blokes. Yeah, I'll give you that. I've not seen too many leather jackets flying around. Thank God.
Do you know? But listen, anybody that I've said that you're coming on the show, guys, they're like, oh God, love him. There is definitely, and I'm not talking about you know people having a sexual crush on you, they just really look up to you. They really, I think for a lot of men, you're the guy they'd like to think they could be or could have been.
Could easily be, to be quite frank. Hopefully they'll never meet me and understand that I'm just this normal bloke that gets a lot of things wrong.
How are you finding your feet with everybody knowing who you are now, having spent 20 years having to fly below the radar, almost literally living in camouflage?
That was probably the biggest shock to the system. Difficult to know how to navigate, but fortunately most people are really nice and have made it easy for me. But I found that weird. I wouldn't have said I found it difficult, I just found it weird. And it's, you know, I suppose you get used to it to a certain degree. But I mean, I live in London, no one cares here. Like, it's so busy, everyone's got stuff to do, they're rushing around. It's when I, you know, if you go out to smaller places, then you're a little bit more noticeable, I suppose. But even then, people are nice, thank God.
What if there's one or two of you together from the show? That must stop people in their
tracks. That's like, that's like, I don't know, people go...
It's like seeing Ant and Dec.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Still haven't met them. Anyway, but... it's like if there's me and Billy, the other guy, people are like, no way. It's like, hey, how's it going? Yeah. And then we get bombarded with loads of questions about people that have been on the show and how they thought they did, and they thought we were unfair or something like that. Yeah. It's quite, that's funny. That's a good bit of it.
I have to say, I just watched the final with Gareth Gates, and I was hosting Pop Idol when Gareth...
Yeah.
First walked onto screen 21 years ago, and you know, he was the kid that couldn't speak but could sing. And to watch him in your final, I was like, well, look at how far he's come. Jeez.
I absolutely love that bloke. Yeah,
it's quite something.
I love him, he's brilliant. He did exceptionally well. I don't think they didn't show enough, and they can't, but they didn't show enough of how good he really was on that. He was leaps and bounds ahead of everyone.
Was he really?
A really determined, I was going to say young man. He's not even a young man anymore. He's a grown up. But yeah, he was quality. He showed all the qualities that we looked for.
Do you think he would have had a chance, you know, I mean, if he weren't the age that he is now, would he have had a chance at being selected?
I mean, the speech thing would have been a drama if he was trying to talk on the radio. But I think he would have done, yeah. I think he definitely would have done. He's so selfless and always was there for other people. He was a good solid character.
Oh, that's nice.
One of my favourites on the show.
That's nice. But also must be weird for you, because we all look at you as like, well, you're the SAS guys, right? You're the, you know, we look up to you, but equally you have civilian lives and civilian existences, and you've probably at times had your own heads turned by some of the people that have been put under your care and instruction.
Yeah. We've had people come on, we're like, no way. Can't believe that they're
really,
you know, yeah, they're on.
But when you're giving them a bee sting, we don't imagine you like having a cup of tea with Billy and Ollie going, oh my God, I can't believe it. Have you seen who's in?
Well, we'll have that discussion before we start. So we find out like 24 hours before normally officially. So we'll be wherever we'll get briefed up on who the celebs are. Then we'll do our little moment of fanboying where we're like, oh, no way. That's awesome. Or, oh my God, I can't believe that person's on. Then we get it out of our system and then we go into the show professionally. So we're like, right, here, we're here to do a job. Don't care who it is. They're getting it or not, as the case may be. Depends. But we have a little, can't believe they're on. And then that's it. It's done.
Love that. Well, like you, I'm here to do a job and I've got three questions for you, Jason. So do you mind if I jump in?
Yeah, let's go.
My first question for you, Foxy. You've said before that a diamond is created under pressure. So what have been the moments that litter your own life journey that have really tested you? How did you navigate them? And ultimately, like a diamond, how have they enabled you to shine, do you think?
So, as with diamonds, diamonds are created from dirt and dark earth and stuff that has been before. And... all, you know, all that stuff that comes under pressure, you know, all gets forced together, creates a diamond, a little bit of science there. And all the stuff that has hopefully made me shine has been the dark moments. There's times when I've either failed or had moments that are quite, I don't know, depressing or sad. It can range from anything from like being in the military and failing something and sort of trying to deal with that failure and bounce back from it and then go again, you know. And I've failed at stuff, you know. There's a couple of things when I was in recruit training that I messed up, and there was something on selection, you know, for the special forces, you know, you don't go through it unscathed. And it's those moments that you sort of reflect on and try and learn what went wrong to then bounce back and do it right. But then ultimately the one thing that I am very, well, I am actually glad that I went through, but also proud that I went through it, is my journey with mental health, because it was hard and I never thought I'd ever be exposed to something like that. I actually never believed in it. I didn't believe that there was such a thing. I thought that's a load of rubbish. You know, you just got to get on with it. And then the next thing you know, I'm eating a big old slice of humble pie because I found myself in a pit. And I needed to dig myself out of it. So that is the most pressurized moment. There's many, you know, being out on the battlefield and being scared. And, you know, you alluded to one of them being in the ditch and thinking about mum and watching Top of the Pops on the sofa as a 10-year-old because that was a safe place. Yeah, they're very poignant and they have their place. But they all led to that dark moment that was being in, you know, being in a really bad place. And it was that was the defining moment for me about using all those negative things to turn them into positive and then become a more understanding person of myself.
Did you talk much around that time, did you talk to anybody before you went and got professional help?
No. Yeah. I clammed up. I was embarrassed. I didn't speak to anyone. I cut myself off from the mates in the military. And it was bizarrely two people I didn't really know that they showed me some affection. There was a guy that gave me a job in the business that I was in at the time, and I didn't do that a justice, but he gave me a job and he said, look, just have this job. And there was a person within that job who always looked out for me. Now, I didn't know them that well. I know them well now, but they had the empathy and the kindness to just keep reaching out and keep helping me move in a direction that was going to be beneficial for my own headspace. And it was the guy that gave me the job that then set me on this journey of finding a professional to help me. I suppose as a clinical psychologist, that's who I found initially. Then I found someone who else was a coach. And it was through their, you know, caring nature that helped me find a way through it. But ultimately, weirdly, it wasn't the people that you thought would be there that I turned to. It was just more like random people. They weren't random, but they weren't close.
But sometimes they're put in your path, aren't they, for a reason? And
definitely.
That person that you're talking about, they were obviously very persistent in their kindness, right?
Mm, very much so.
And a clinical psychologist is kind of a big place to start. So what were the powers of persuasion that person had that made you open to that? Because if you didn't believe in therapy, going in at a sort of clinical psychology level is quite, that's the deep end.
Yeah. So basically, the guy that gave me the job, Andy, he's an MD. He was the MD of this business. He was like, mate, I can see that you're struggling. I don't know how. I must have had a look on my face or just the way I held myself. And he was, I'm going to help you. And he said, we're going to go on this journey and we're going to, you know, find the right person. And he basically allowed me through the benefits that he had in the business. Not that I was entitled to them. He used his benefits to help me find this person. Now, I've met a few people.
Like private healthcare, yeah?
Yeah, like private healthcare that came with, you know, the package. And I couldn't afford it. There's no way I could have afforded it. I didn't, you know, the job, I had a lot of things going on. And, you know, I met a few people, they weren't right. And he said, look, doesn't matter if they're not right, we'll just keep going. We'll find another person. And I met this lady called Alex, clinical psychologist. She was and is, she still is, we're friends now. We sort of do business together. But that's a separate thing that came years later. I'd lost touch with her from yonks and then came about, but anyway, met her and she was like, you know, we did a few sessions in a clinical room and I was like, I hate this, I just can't be in this. And she was like, well, that's great because I'm actually going to get kicked out of here soon. We've got to find a new place. And I was like, look, I want to be outdoors. And she goes, well, that suits me. And I thought, oh, this is all right, you know. Anyway, we then, you know, progressed on and went for walks in the woods and talked about stuff and explored stuff. And, you know, I liked it, connected, did well out of it. And she'd said the right things to help me and move in the right direction.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there's so much power in taking you out of a room and sticking you in nature, right? Just like going for a walk with somebody and talking feels normal. Sat in a room... Yeah. Talking at somebody doesn't.
And that's horrible.
You probably felt far more open to working with her just by getting out of that room, I would have thought.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, she's a clinical psychologist, but she's quite holistic as well in her sort of approach to things, which I think worked well for me, which is bizarre because I never saw myself as a hippie. It turns out I am in disguise. There we go.
Are you really?
Well, I don't know, maybe. Just without the long hair and the split.
What did she unlock in you?
She taught me to be accepting of stuff, life. And she showed me that we need to be more present. And I was at that moment in time, and I've been very good at being present before that when I was in the military. It's like, it's what gets you through those difficult times is being present. and understanding there is no then or thereafter, because the only thing that's real is now. But after, you know, or going through that phase of poor mental health, I became so obsessed with the past and worried about the future because of the past that I wasn't present ever. I was like this shell of an individual that just stared through people, I think, because I was thinking of other things that weren't real. And she was able to get me to realise that. And yeah, it made a big difference.
How are you connecting past events to... Were you catastrophizing over things that had gone wrong and how they might impact your future? Is that where you were?
I think there was a lot. It's complex. But I was looking back at everything, like decisions made, the way I acted, the way I came across, how I was in work life, how I was in personal life. You know, I was probably quite angry at times. I, you know, through the pure nature of the job, I was probably aggressive with regard to the way I projected myself. At work, definitely, you can get away with it there. But I was just, I don't think I was a great, although, you know, I mean, me and my mates, we had a great time, but I just don't think I was absent.
You talk about anger and aggression there, but you always, I've heard you say before that as a soldier, serving in the special forces, you had to have aggression, but never anger. And you seem to really understand the nuance that separated the two emotions, because they can quite often cloud one another.
Yeah, they can. And the weird thing is, I've never been angry when I've been in a work situation that dictates fighting and violence. I can categorically say I've never been angry, because it would never, it's almost like taught out of you to be like that. But, you know, I did it, you know, in the past, I found myself getting angry at the most ridiculous of things, stubbing your toe. I mean, actually, you're probably allowed to get angry at stubbing your toe. That's pretty brutal. But, you know, just the little things I would get angry at. And I was, you know, it wasn't right, and it took a while for me to realise that. And maybe that was
so my... You could handle the big stuff, the enormous stuff. You just couldn't handle the little stuff in life.
Yeah, I think I was happy with the chaos. I felt... Yeah. When things sound or feel like they're going to go chaotic, I feel like I'm like, yay, here we go. This is where I'm at.
This is when you shine.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, so there that's we go. That...
That's the shining moment, is chaos.
Yeah. Which, in so many ways, it's a bit like, you know, when you see these young men and women have, I don't know, successful acting careers or careers in music, and everything's amazing, and then it stops in their, like, late 20s, early 30s, and you go, shh, like, that is that the best years of my life behind me? Do you think in so many ways, being serving in the special forces, there was an element of that you're never going to get those highs, that level of adrenaline again?
Yeah, you do. You think it's the end. And I think a lot of people go through that, whether athletes, professional, you know, like you've just mentioned, actors, anyone that's enjoyed their career and a career that is...
Yeah, athletes is a really good example.
Yeah, and a career that is never going to last longer than, you know, 20... if you're lucky, 30 years, because it's just not practical, then you are always going to be like, oh, that's it, it's over. That's the best years of my life gone. Now, the reason that becomes depressive is because that person adopts that mindset. Oh, that's it, my best years are done. When actually it's just like, right, that's that chapter done. What are the next ones looking like? Now, I adopted the old, that's it now, it's over. The one thing I enjoyed, the one thing that I was good at is now gone. What's the point? And I did adopt that mindset for a bit, and it was terrible for me. But then, you know, now I'm not like that. I'm like, right, okay, this is me. I'm getting older as we go, but how am I going to keep myself, you know, excited and enjoying life? And, you know, that's the fun of it. That's the journey, you know. I don't know all the answers. None of us do, but it's about having that approach to anything you do, that you want to turn it into a fun, enjoyable experience.
the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I want to talk to you about the power of reinvention. I think, you know, what we've touched on there is the challenges and the wins that it brings when you are forced to re-identify who you are. So you knew exactly who you were good at being a soldier, it's where you shone. The chaos brought out the very best in you. And then suddenly, the only battlefield that you were attending to was the one in your own mind, because you were without identity, to some degree purpose, away from the structure of life in the forces. And it took you to the very edge. I mean, you write in your book about wanting to take your own life. So how did you begin to re-identify and reinvent yourself? And how can that be passed to other people that come and watch your shows or listen to this podcast? Because I think all of us are called upon at times to reimagine, reinvent, re-identify who we are.
So it's a big question. There's a few stages to coming up with an answer, and the answer is different in everyone, but you've got to accept. So in reinvention, you've got to accept that something has obviously come or is coming to its natural finish point. Whether you think it's natural or not, it is. It's just the way it is. Then you've got to be honest with yourself about how you feel about that, and allow yourself to grieve as well, because a lot of people are like, oh, I shouldn't be feeling like this. But if you naturally feel a certain way, that is your body telling you that that's how you feel. And we always try and suppress grief or sadness, but ultimately we should probably embrace it a bit more and be like, okay, I feel sad, that's because this has happened, and it's, you know, not happy with it, but because if we accept that a little bit more, then it gives us the opportunity to move forward. So that's the honesty thing, being honest with yourself, honest about your emotions and not trying to hide them. You know, I tried to hide for a long time from myself that I actually was suffering psychologically. I was just lying to myself about, oh yeah, whatever, yeah, I've admitted it, but not really going to address it. Then you've got to treat life as a journey. Now, as far as I'm concerned, a journey's got to be fun. It's hard, but it should predominantly be fun. You're going to meet a lot of people on the way. Some of them you might like, some of them you might not. It doesn't matter. It's all part of the tapestry, and you will learn something from all of them, whether it's a way not to do something, or in the good way, the way to do something. So I think a lot of about the reinvention thing is accepting, being honest, and then, you know, going on a journey and turning it into fun. Only we are in charge of how we feel, and we can change how we feel by rethinking. Do you know what I mean? I'm going off on a bit of a tangent here.
To a degree, I think if you're clinically depressed, you probably don't have that power over your own ability to change the way you think. But I think fundamentally, absolutely, you're right.
If you're clinically depressed, that's correct. But like the only person in the end that is going to fix you is you. That, like, yeah, there's lots of people that can help you, but if you are in a period where you don't want to be fixed, you won't be fixed. There has to be that point in time where you're like, right, now I need to really dig deep. And there is no magic wand. There is no easy way to fix mental health. You have to put in graft. And it isn't a quick process. And the sooner you're like, right, okay, it's going to be a bit of hard work, I think the sooner you will get yourself out of it and you'll be in a better place personally.
Well, you've got to recognise it's work for a start, right? In the States, they call it, I've done some work on myself, right? And they call it that for a reason. And we just think that if I go into the appointments and sitting there and talking to somebody, that you're going to come out magically with all the answers. And no. I mean, it just doesn't work like that. It's that they give you the tools to, and a therapy session is something that happens within the hour, but should go on inside your head for days, weeks, sometimes months, as you
the therapy
put together
session,
the puzzle of your mind.
Yeah, the therapy session is like the lesson, and then the rest of it's homework. You got to do your homework after that. They've given you some stuff, and then you've got to do something with that stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the stuff that's the tricky bit. But along the way, you said it. You know, life should be fun. When did you start to feel that the fun had come back into your world again? Was it when you were back in sort of more familiar territory, like, you know, assisting crews in hostile environments? You know, that must have felt a bit more like your old playground.
Yeah, so not long before getting that job, I reconnected with a lot of my mates that I was close to, so predominantly military, but some of them not. Met some new mates and just started to have fun again. And, you know, a mate of mine, Aldo, he gave me the job just off the coast of Madagascar, working for a production crew, looking after them. And I was like, this is awesome. I love this. You know, I'm back in the mix. I'm doing something. I've got purpose. This is my new identity. And I finished that job needing that job. I needed it. It was definitely a lifesaver.
Is this
gave me
the
a
one
bit
where
of money.
You were, is this the one where you discovered, where you were leading the part of the team of divers who discovered Captain Kidd's lost treasure?
Yeah, so I wasn't leading it. So there was a bunch of underwater archaeologists that were looking for stuff. Then I was the underwater cameraman's dive buddy. So all I was supposed to be doing was looking after him when he filmed stuff. Me and him got bored one day, went and dived on a pirate shipwreck and found a bar of silver. because of that, it was awesome. It was great.
Bar we found of this silver. From how long ago?
1600s. 17th century.
How much was that worth?
God knows. Priceless. It's gone missing. I don't know where it is now. It's probably on the president of Madagascar's desk as a paperweight. But it's a pretty big paperweight. But, yeah. But no, because of that,
it mysteriously disappeared.
Yeah, nowhere near me. Nowhere near me. we'd have got
just
lynched.
Checking.
Yeah, no.
Wow, so hold on, right? So you go to, for a start, you're back in foreign climes, which is where you'd spent the latter part of your life in service. So suddenly that must feel in itself like a return to something familiar. You're part of a team.
Yeah.
There's a familiarity in that. And then you're doing something that there's real jeopardy, but a shared purpose, which is we're going to dive, we're going to get to this wreck. That must have felt so good again.
Yeah, it was awesome. I loved it. It was a four-week trip. Mm. It was about 4 weeks. We were staying on this small tropical island just off Madagascar. It was amazing. It was really, really good. Good people. Had a laugh. Got pissed every night. And just enjoyed it. But because I came back from that job needing it. My mate Aldo that gave me the job knew I was in a right pickle. I was living on a mate's sofa. I had no money. And he was like, I came back from that. Didn't know what was next. And then because of that job, someone was in a meeting that was like, a development stroke commissioning meeting for what would then become SAS, Who Dares Wins. And they were like, right, you know, we're going to commission this, but where the hell are we going to find these ex-special forces guys? And someone was like, well, maybe we should phone this guy, Foxy. He's just been out in Madagascar. So that's how it sort of came around. There's a lot more to it than that, but that's how, you know, that's sort of, in a nutshell, what happened. And I was like, well, yeah.
I had a similar show experience, not quite at the level that you worked at. But 20 years ago, I did a show called Lads Army. Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah, it was good.
I loved that show. And then they turned it into Bad Lads Army, which was a shame. But it was basically calling up what would effectively be classed as disaffected youths, right? Mm. And putting them through old school, what's the word for it? Before you go into the army?
National service.
National service. Oh, my God. Jesus Christ. Yeah. Honestly, I feel like I'm Eunice Stubbs sometimes and Give Us a Clue.
I've got it, though.
Welcome to the midlife woman, Foxy. It was all about that. But what would it do for the nation if we called these young men back to national service? And I have to say, it was transformative. They're still in touch now, 20 years on. They still do reunions. I still hear from them. It meant enormous amounts to them all. And I could see the genuine benefits of it. But to be suddenly tugged out of that must be, heartbreaking, but B, to then be thrust into something that feels like, oh, that feels like that again. That must have been very exciting.
It was really exciting.
And then the chance to put it all together.
Yeah, it was really exciting. It was... I didn't know what was coming after that Madagascan trip, to be honest. And when I first got asked to do the show that would then become SAS, I was like, no, I'm not doing it. Then I remembered I needed... because I wasn't happy with the way it sat with me, as in being an ex-Special Forces soldier and being in front of the camera. I mean, at first I was like, well, you're obviously going to pixelate my face. And they were like, no. They're like, that doesn't engage, it's not engaging, the audience don't like it. And I was like, oh, I don't know about this. And I sort of spoke to a few people and I was like, it just doesn't, I don't know, I just don't know. And then a mate of mine was like, mate, you're living on your mate's sofa, you know, you haven't got a pot to pee in. Like, what if you don't do it, someone else is, and it's up to you to make a good job of it. And I was like, okay, I see what you're saying. So we went through this whole rigmarole of a conversation that went on for about 2 weeks. And then I was like, right, let's do it. Just accept that you're going to do it. There might be a bit of hate come your way, but ultimately I'm doing it because... And the reason I was doing it, there's a couple of reasons. One, I was discharged from the military with PTSD. That meant any job that my career would lend itself to, I couldn't get because I'm seen as being a bit mad. So, you know, all the close protection stuff, working with weapons, because I've got a history of mental health, they're not going to give me those jobs that give me security. And so I was struggling because of that. And then the other reason was because I thought, right, there's an opportunity here for me to have a platform to talk about my mental health, and in turn, maybe that resonates somewhere. And so that's what happened. And and I needed to pay the bills. I was running out of dollar.
Big time, yeah. With children to feed and, you know, life to uphold and support. Who put the crew together? Were you the first to get the call?
There's been a couple of people actually in the mix. I was one of the first. A couple of people dropped out. Then me and Ollie we were on board. I was like, okay, do you need more people? They were like, yes. I just reconnected with Ollie after years of not seeing him. He had disappeared off the face of the planet. Got him on. Then me and him went away on a recce with a couple of the crew, and we sort of like did the sort of bulk of looking at locations in Wales and coming up with a loose training program, which then got developed. And then... the others came on board. We went back to Wales to then start the prep, and then we went and rolled straight into the shoot. And it was a brand new experience. And I was like, this is awesome. But I genuinely thought it would be one of these flash in the pan shows that would resonate with a small community and then fade into obscurity. And I genuinely thought that. Although one of the directors, actually, I remember we'd just finished filming. We're walking down the main road of the location. And he's like, how do you lads feel about this? And I was like, yeah, it's all right, wasn't it? And he was like, he goes, this is going to be big. And I'm like, you reckon? And he's like, we've seen everything. And I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. And I thought, what the hell does he know? Anyway, he was right to a certain degree.
Do you know what? I had to judge it for Royal Television Society Awards. So when you agree to judge on the RTS Awards, they send you 25, 30 shows that then get shortlisted. You have to watch all of them. And I would never have sat down and opted to hit download on a show called SAS.
No.
Because it's just probably not where I'd spend probably the 1 hour a day I sit in front of the telly.
Neither would I, if it makes you feel better.
No, well, I don't know. I mean, they're more of a busman's holiday for you, I suppose. But, oh my God, I was obsessed. I ended up... Obviously, devouring every episode. I think. Did you win that year? I think you did. I remember being in the judges room and nobody being able to pick a hole.
We've never won anything. We've been nominated, but we've never won anything.
Well, that's outrageous. I thought it was marvellous. In that first series, there was a guy that I don't know, a Welsh guy. First ever series. You were in a jungle. I know this is not helpful, but. I just saw the impact you had on him. You managed to break and remake people on that show in a way that was unlike anything else, and it was very powerful.
Yeah, it was great. It is good. I do enjoy it. It's good seeing the people overcome their barriers, and it's only them that overcome it. We're just there to facilitate the journey.
Well, that's not entirely true. You do a little bit more than that, I'd say. And what's it like to be reunited with some of your old colleagues? Because you've got... I know Ant's been on the show before. He was SBS as well. Did you serve with Ant?
Yeah, vaguely. He's a bit younger than me. Ollie as well. There's been crossover with all of them. Me and Billy, he was in at the same time. And we've all served together or at the same time. We've all seen each other, bumped into each other, that sort of stuff.
Are you happy with where you've landed in terms of your reinvention now? Do you like Foxy as he stands in 2023? Have you learnt to forgive and accept all of the iterations that went before in order for you to become who you are now?
Yeah, I think so. I'm happy with where I'm at. I'm always striving to be a better version of me. I'm always going to get mess things up every now and again. I hope not. And I just, when I do, I want to learn from them. So I hope I'm an all right person to be around. And I don't mind my own company. So I'm happy at the moment. Yeah.
Are you ready for your third and final question?
Yeah, let's go.
Plot twists. From finding a career in the Special Forces to fame on the telly to marrying recently, congratulations, by the way. When has life thrown you some plot twists that changed everything? The kind of stuff that you could never have planned for.
When? Crikey. I mean, the biggest plot twist was definitely leaving the military. I wasn't ready to do that. It happened, and it happened quickly. That's the biggest twist, because I didn't see myself leaving. I thought I was going to have a much longer career, and I wanted to. So that's the major twist. I mean, there's loads of little ones in between, but I've never really been overwhelmed by them.
So you hadn't seen that coming?
No, I didn't. Even when I went and presented myself to psychological professionals, because I felt a bit different, I didn't think I'd be leaving, and I didn't want to leave even when I left. I just accepted that must have been what's happening. So yeah, that was definitely the biggest twist, but it's taught me to realize that, you know, anything can change at the drop of a hat. So it's been a beneficial to me massively. I've made that twist has turned into a lesson.
Well, you said before that you had never considered that your mind would go before your body. And with that came a sort of sense of shame for you, to the point that you didn't even tell your colleagues that you'd been discharged with PTSD. You said it was tinnitus.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you were clearly still struggling to come to terms with it all. That's a real shame. And the fact that you've then gone on to speak about your struggles with mental health, that then kind of ruled you out of any work, really, in close protection. You were forced to go and find this really quite extreme new identity, in as much as it's as close to your old one, but you're like in the public eye, because what most men do leaving the regiments that you'd served in was to go and work as a close protection officer or with weapons. But you, because of the PTSD, you knew you were never going to get those gigs. Mm. So that was really, I mean, that's a shit pie right there.
Yeah, it was. I don't know what I was expecting, to be honest. And I can remember being told, you know, when I said, look, I'm obviously ill, what needs to happen. And, you know, there was a few professionals there and they said, look, the one thing that will fix you is for you to leave the military. And I was like, really? I said, like, I don't want to do that. And they're like, yeah, but, you know, you've come to that time now. And it's like, what? And I kicked back on it because I knew the outcome wouldn't be good. You know, I knew that it would stop me doing a lot of things that I could potentially do. And then it got to the point where I was struggling. You know, I was in a deep bout of depression and I ended up going back to the work, get back to them and saying, look, you're obviously right, let's go. And then within about 2 months, I was done. And then I woke up that next morning when I was officially a civilian and I felt worse because I basically wasn't part of something anymore. But that started the journey. But ultimately that's the plot twist. But it's worked in my favour. You know what I mean? It's forced me to look at a very diverse approach to where I'm and what I'm doing going forward. Because it is, you know, I never saw this world coming.
And you know what? It's really powerful that certainly for so many men that don't open up and talk about how they feel and could really benefit from doing so. First of all, they sort of fell in love with you as Foxy from SAS. And then you started talking about this. There was real power in that. That was a sucker punch you delivered right there. Because it's like, whoa, hold on. So, oh, you did? And you think therapy is good? And, oh, right. And you're not infallible? I mean, it's probably hard to measure how much good will come of that. Are you in any way aware of that? Is it tangible to you in any way?
About the impact?
Yeah, on everyday men that came to you not because they wanted mental health advice, just because they wanted to be like you. And then when you start to talk, they're like, oh, I mean, you must have helped a lot of men without even helping a lot of men, you know?
I hope so. I'm aware of it to the degree that I get messages and I'm very grateful for those. I'm humbled by it. I don't know what I thought was going to come from it. I just thought, I genuinely thought it was just the right thing to do, I think. And that's why I did it. And then I was scared about doing it, but there was something inside me that said, you've got to do this. And then it just sort of, it went okay.
I think it's gone more than okay. You're on your second sellout tour. Tickets are available now. There's two books. There's a Netflix documentary series. There's the 48 Hours With show, which are on Channel 4 at the moment, on 4OD, where you spend 48 hours with Rob Delaney. What a lovely man. And Maya Jama.
He is. And she is as well.
Nice to see her in your environment, by the way. I wish you nothing but success with whatever comes next. And do keep the conversation going when it comes to men and their mental health, because I honestly think that you're doing way more good than you could ever probably even begin to anticipate or imagine. So thank you for your time.
Thanks
today.
Very much. Cheers.
My huge thanks to Foxy, and if you'd like to go and join him for an evening to hear about his life at the limit, well, tickets are available wherever you get your tickets right now. And for more tales of extraordinary adventures, you can find episodes with adventurer Simon Reeve in our back catalogue, as well as Craig Doll, who talks to us about going to Belize and getting drunk with Cameron Diaz. Ant Middleton's in there giving his own take on his experience, both in the Special Forces and working alongside Foxy on SAS. And Andrew McLean's in there talking about how breaking down on SAS was ultimately the making of her.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.